Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about thread scheduling, and we started by talking about very simple schedulers. Our simplest was first come, first served, and we found that that was what optimized throughput. It minimized the overhead of making a complicated decision about what to run and of having many context switches. But often that wasn't what we were looking for. And when we're doing further analysis, we discovered a sort of idealistic scheduler that would minimize sort of responsiveness, or response time, so maximize responsiveness in some sense, and that was shortest remaining time first. But we had a problem that we couldn't actually implement that in practice, so we talked about strategies based on priority scheduling, where he said, well, shortest remaining time first runs things at higher, lower remaining time earlier. So let's use a priority scheduler with higher priorities having the things with shorter remaining times. And we'll guess what has a shorter remaining time, because we can't figure that out exactly based on what happened previously. So we have this approximation of multi-level feedback queues for shortest remaining time first. There's some others out there that we alluded to. We also looked at a completely different goal of fairness, and we had our lottery scheduler, sort of a more flexible fair scheduler, that where we could have our fairness be not just everything is equal, but we could assign weights. And we had a deterministic version of that, where we looked at what the Linux completely fair scheduler did, which essentially also, you know, has this notion of fairness, but with proportional shares, where some amount you're entitled to that might be more than others, and also tried to deal with, well, what if you do I/O for a bit? Does that really mean you don't deserve as much CPU time? And Linux said, as long as it's short enough, it doesn't. If it's too long, it does. And we also mentioned our strict priority scheduler. So we mentioned priority schedulers as sort of a way to build our shortest remaining time first approximation. But we also mentioned them sort of as a means to an end. If we have sort of a strict hierarchy we want to enforce, that's the scheduler to do it. Okay, so before I move on, any questions about things we covered last time? Schedulers. So there's one type of scheduler that's on here that I'm just going to mention. We're not going to cover it. So that's for real-world deadlines. And I'm mentioning, so the algorithm name here is earliest deadline first. You can probably guess how that works. There's some other algorithms in this family where you have some real-world deadline. And an example of that is like, I'm writing the computer that controls the brakes in the car, and there's a point in time by which I better tell the brake what to do or else things go really wrong. So if you have a system like that, you want to use a scheduler that actually guarantees that, which is not the ones we talked about directly. Okay. So any questions before I move on to our topic for the day, which is about threads and programming with threads in general? Okay, so we're going to talk about programming with threads, and by threads, I mean in the same process. So presumably, we have one sort of overarching task that we're doing with multiple threads. We don't have independent programs, but they're somehow related. And there's two ways we're going to talk about doing related things. So one is with what I'll call concurrency, which is where we have one overarching task, but we have different pieces of it that are happening at the same time. So like we have a web server that's serving one website, but we have different users requesting different parts of that website, and we might have different threads to handle each of the users. The threads are sharing data about what's on the website, but they're otherwise acting independently. Or we might have different tabs in a web browser. They have to coordinate to figure out who's the right active tab. They might have to share some information, but they're otherwise mostly independent as far as what they're doing. and they're handling different tasks. Or you might imagine something like a game where you have like a thread for playing audio, a thread for getting and processing the keyboard input, and other tasks divided up in that sort of way. So I'll call this concurrent. We'll also talk about parallelism, where I have one single task that would be most natural to do sort of, you know, as one single thread, but that's not good enough probably for performance. So you want to make that faster. And we'll have an example of this in an upcoming assignment. So we're going to have an assignment where you're going to do a simulation. We'll give you a single-threaded just loop that does the simulation, and we want you to make it faster by using multiple threads. And this will be faster, assuming we have multiple cores. So that's going to be one of our big use cases for threads, is that we have one task. We're just dividing it up so we can use multiple cores. Or we have one overarching goal, and we have separate, mostly independent tasks with some coordination, which is our concurrency. Note for concurrency that using threads in that case is beneficial, arguably, even if we don't have multiple cores, because it still is helpful to divide the task up into these separate pieces and to make sure one piece doesn't wait on the other unnecessarily. Like one user's request can, if it stalls, it doesn't delay another user's request to the same web server. This is our context. We're going to be a little far apart from actual applications for a while. I just want to set the stage. Now, we're going to talk about how threads work, and I'm going to assume a threading model called kernel threads, that we talked about scheduling threads, and we gave you the impression that there's a scheduler in the operating system kernel that schedules all the threads. And that's what we're going to assume, that all the threads are scheduled directly by the OS kernel. And this is the most common model today. This is how most operating systems work for most programs. But it is not the only way to do multi-threaded programs. And in fact, historically, it wasn't even the most common. So an alternate idea is that you can have library code that's not in the kernel handle threads, and then the OS scheduler schedules programs which schedule their own threads. So there's a hierarchy of schedulers. So that's a model which is still possible and historically very common, but it's not common today. And the main thing that's happened, which made it uncommon, is that this hierarchy of schedulers is really awkward with multi-core. Because if we want to take advantage of multiple cores, we want to figure out what program has the most work to do and give that all the cores it needs. And if we have this hierarchy of schedulers, it's hard to arrange for that to happen. So since the kernel is dealing directly with all the threads, we're going to have our thread state separated from the rest of our process state. So we'll have what we'll call a thread control block, which contains the register, stack pointer, program counter, and so on for each thread. Its scheduling state, so whether each thread is runnable, waiting for some piece of I/O, and so on, and any other information we need. And we'll have that separate from the process state, which will be like the memory of the thread, what files it has open, its process ID, and each process control block will be associated with the list of threads, so it will have a list of thread control blocks. And our OS scheduler is just going to deal with the thread control blocks and running those. So this is the conceptual model I'm going to use. So before we move on, questions about what's in the thread control block. Now, some OSs don't quite work this way, and Linux is an example of this. So Linux doesn't choose to have really an obvious process or thread control block, even though it has that kernel threading model, that the kernel schedules each thread. Instead, Linux has a single task data structure that represents a thread, but rather than having threads that point to process control blocks and vice versa, the task structure has a pointer to what's the current address space, the memory, what's the current list of open files. These are all pointers, and multiple tasks can share the same pointer. So you can have several tasks which point to the same open files, the same address space, and so on. And those are basically all threads in the same process. Even though there's not actually the concept of a process in the kernel. And the advantage of this approach is that by doing this, the Linux kernel basically has no special logic for threads. Everything's a task. If you want to figure out what the task files are, use the pointer to the files. You don't care that there's a bunch of tasks in the same process. You just care that they have a pointer to files, and it happens to be the same just by coincidence. And to implement this, the Linux generalizes the fork API. So the fork call in Linux is actually implemented using a system call called clone, which takes a set of flags for what do you want to copy. What do you want to share. So if you supply flags of 0, it says you want to share nothing, copy everything. But you can say, hey, I want to share the open files. Don't copy the open files, just have the same pointer after you do it. Or I want to share the address space. Or you can do all of them together, which is what we're going to do when we spawn a new thread in Linux. And as a minor point here, you see there's a new stack pointer. If we're sharing the address space for our new task, well, then things would get really confusing if we keep using the same stack. So the solution for that is that this clone system call lets you specify a new stack pointer, which works the same sort of way that fork can return two different values. We can set a new stack pointer in the new thread, i.e. the new task set of registers. So this is the internals, and this is an elegant design because the kernel, in a sense, doesn't need to know about what processes are. It just knows about these generalization of threads. Not all OSs do it, so Windows, for example, doesn't work this way. Now, we're not going to be using this low-level API of clone. We're going to talk about the POSIX API for threads. And unlike the POSIX APIs we've looked at so far with like fork, open, read, and write, the functions I'm going to show you for POSIX threads are going to be pretty far removed from the system calls that typically implement them. So with fork, typically there's something that pretty directly corresponded to the fork system call. So in Linux, it's not actually a fork system call, but it's just clone with particular arguments, basically. You know, there's a one-to-one correspondence. We're going to talk about functions for implementing threads, which are more abstracted away from the system calls that implement them, and where there's not going to be an obvious correspondence. So this is a more of a higher level-ish interface to programming a process with multiple threads. And we're going to start with the thread create function. And here's our thread create function. So I have a program that uses the POSIX threads API. We declare two pthreadTs, which are thread IDs, so the equivalent of PIDs. And we create a thread to run the computePy function and a thread to run the print class list function, and then have some more code in the main function. And when this runs, main's going to run. It's going to run the first pthread create, and a computePy thread will start, and it will just start running. It will run whenever the schedulers decide to run it. And then main will also keep running. It will run the second pthread create, and the print class list function will start running. And it will run whenever the scheduler decides to run it, and the main function will still run, running this code here. So they'll all run at the same time. When exactly they run depends on what the scheduler decides to do. So questions about anything here besides what the arguments to pthread create are, which I'll talk about on the next slide. Yes?
So under the hood, is it still using fork?
So the question is, under the hood, is it using fork? So fork is not going to work directly because fork doesn't share the address space. And as we're going to see later, these threads are going to be in the same address space. So like if you modify a global variable in one, you can read it from another, which after fork wasn't true. Like we copied all that memory. So they're going to have to be implemented with a different underlying system call. So on Linux, the system call is clone, but we specify clone VM, clone files, and everything else that we can share. But fork is not going to do it because fork copies too much rather than sharing it, keeping it shared between the two threads. Okay, other questions? Okay, so you have this pthread create function. Let's talk about the arguments, especially since there's some nulls here. So the first argument is a pointer to a thread identifier. So this is going to be filled in using the point by dereferencing the pointer by pthread create to give you an ID that you can use for other functions. We'll see one example later with the equivalent of the wait PID function, but for threads, we'll take IDs like this. That's going to be how we can refer to the thread later. We also have the function to run. And this function has to take a void star argument and return a void star result. So pointer to void, which is a container which contains a pointer to any type by casting to and from it. This is always the prototype of that function. If you don't want to use the argument, well, that's too bad. It has to be there. If you don't want to use the return value, that's too bad. It has to be there. So in this case, for example, we don't care about the argument, but we still had to pass null. Okay. So the other arguments, we have this first null is the thread attribute. So there's a way of specifying extra information about how I want the thread set up. We'll see some examples of that later. And the last argument is what's going to be passed to the function that starts the thread. As an argument, in this case, we're passing null, but we can see later that we can pass something more useful. So questions? Got the tags here. Okay. So since we've seen pthread create, here's an example program. I print about to start thread. I call pthread create, creating a thread that calls this print message function with a null argument, returns null, and it just prints in the thread and then returns. Then I print done starting thread and return zero. And I ran this on my computer several thousand times, and about 4% of the time in the thread was printed, otherwise it wasn't. What happened? Why 96% of the time did it not print in the thread? Yes? So you're saying it's because it returns from main. And that is exactly what happens. So the main thread is special. So we'd expect, you know, if the main thread finishes, there's still other things to do. Why would we not schedule that other thread and print out the message? But this is not how POSIX works. Returning from main exits the entire process, all the threads in the process. As does calling exit, the exit function. And why this happened only sometimes is that we had this race. If main was fast enough, then it would exit before print message printed the message. And that happened on my system 96% of the time with how the scheduler worked. And so on. And if it's not fast enough, then the message will get printed before main exits and terminates all the threads in the program. So this is just a choice POSIX made that the first thread in the program is special in how main works. So how can we fix this? How can we avoid having this inconsistent behavior? Well, what we want to do is something we've seen a version of for processes, is we have to wait for this thread to finish. Kind of like when we had our shell, we want to wait for a program to finish before we ask for the next program. And there's a way of doing that in POSIX, which is going to be our equivalent of wait PID, and this is pthread join. So pthread join takes the thread ID as an argument. So notice that I passed a pointer to pthread create to set the ID. I'm not passing a pointer to just use it because I'm not changing it. And it also takes a place to store the return value. I pass null because I don't care about the return value of the thread. And this is basically like wait PID, with the, we're waiting for a thread, getting its status. So just a different function name, but same functionality as wait PID, but for threads, not processes. So questions? Yes. So now in this code, we won't return from main and therefore exit the program until after that print message thread finishes. Now, it's still going to be the case that because print message and the main thread are running at the same time, and it's up to the scheduler what's going to happen, that done starting thread and in the thread could be printed in any order. But at least they'll both get printed. So there's another solution we could have, and which is that it's observing the problem was that returning from main exited the entire program. Is there some way we can stop the main thread without doing that? And there is. I don't recommend doing this, but to explain how things work, mentioning that we have an equivalent for exit, but for threads, called pthread exit. So exit exits the whole process. Pthread exit exits the current thread only. So if we call pthread exit for main, that exits the main thread without exiting the whole process. So the other threads in the process can keep running, and we'll still get the in the thread message printed, even if main calls pthread exit before the other thread is done. So I don't recommend doing this, but I'm doing this to explain that the main thread, you know, is not that special, and also to mention that we have an analogy to both wait PID and exit here. Yes? So the question is, if I had code after this exit here, is this unreachable? Yes. Pthread exit, like exit, doesn't return. Okay, other questions? Okay, so pthread join, pthread exit. So pthread join waits for a thread, returns, and this is via modifying a pointer, modifying a pointed to value, because remember we have that second argument, returns the return value of the thread, and pthread exit exits the thread. So this is pthread joins, basically wait PID but for threads. Pthread exits is exit but for threads instead of processes. Questions? So now that we have a way of starting and stopping threads, let's go through a less contrived example of using threads. So our original example, I had computing pi and printing a class list at the same time. That's pretty useless. We might as well use separate programs. So let's do something where the threads are kind of working together. So my running example for today, I'm going to say we have an array of values. And our goal is going to be to sum up the entire array, and we're going to split up the work between two threads. So I'm going to have one thread sum the first half of the array, the second thread sum the second half, and then I'm going to add the two partial sums together to get my final results. And here's my code to do that. So I have two functions. I have sumFront, which sums from 0 to 512, sumBack, which sums from 512 to 1024, and I'm going to create one thread to call some front, one to call some back, and then wait for them to finish and get the results. I could have used the return value to get the results, but rather than dealing with stuffing things in void star pointers, I decided to use a global variable. I also have a global variable so both of the threads can access the same array. Questions about how this code works. Okay, so when we run this code, we're going to have our two threads. We're going to have our values and results in shared memory, and each of the threads, because they have their own stack pointer, and we don't want them to interfere with each other, are going to have their own stack. So when we start the two threads, we're going to allocate two new stacks for each of the threads. And we're also going to have two new thread control blocks. So the thread control blocks, when the threads aren't running, are going to have pointers to those thread stacks. And the program counter for each of the threads is going to be ones in some front, ones in some back as they're running. And they're all going to be able to access values to get the things to sum up, and the results array to store their results, which will then be read by the function which created the threads after they finish. Okay. Questions? Yes. So a complaint you might have about the code I showed you is we had two separate functions for each of the threads. That seems kind of inconvenient. Seems like this is really annoying if I want to like have a version of this if we have what, 4 threads or 8 threads or 7 threads. Like it seems like really tedious to get all those different versions. We just want this to be parameterized. And we want to just write one copy of this function rather than having 2 copies where I've just changed a whole bunch of numbers. We want to pass in an argument to fix that, so let's do that. So I have the same setup here. I have global variables, but I'm going to pass in an argument, which is an ID number. So I'm going to pass in this I here, and I'm just converting it to a pointer just because that's the type that pthread expects, not because it's actually a pointer. So I'm storing an integer in a pointer and extracting it by casting it back to an integer. So basically, I'm pretending it's a pointer to address 1 or address 0, depending on whether it's thread 0 or thread 1. And then extracting that address as an ID. Then based on that ID, I compute my start and finish index. So this here is pointer to address I, not to I. This is not a pointer to I. And this is get the address of pointer as int. Okay, that's just the easiest way of storing an integer in a void with a void star. So questions? Here. Now, if you're thinking about making this code reusable and configurable, you're probably still disappointed because I still have this 512 hard-coded here and this 2 hard-coded here. We want to do better, we need to pass something more complicated than just one number to the thread. Right here, I'm just passing 0 or 1. Here the thread, I really want to pass, you know, a whole bunch of values, so I'm going to make a struct. So I have a struct I call threadInfo, I have a start and end location, and I'm also going to have this struct have the result of the thread. So this is going to be to send values to the thread, and for the thread to return back to the function which started it. So in my function which creates the threads, I just allocate a local variable, which is an array of this struct, and I fill it in before calling the threads. And when the thread is done, it writes to the result field of that struct, which I extract after it finishes. And I have this function still hard coding 512, but now this is much easier to fix and have a more version of this function, which, you know, we can choose the number of threads to run. Okay, so questions about this code? Okay, so when this runs, we have this myInfo, which was from the argument for each of the threads, and that points to a variable in the main thread, which started them. So it actually points to the stack of the main thread. There's the info array. They have a pointer to each element. And we still are accessing the values from a global value. Some questions? Sure. Now, if we're thinking about making this code modular, we still have this problem that the values here is a global variable, but we can fix that by just adding it to our struct that we pass in. So here a pointer to those values. And now we don't have any dependence on global variables, even though we sort of had to have a global function that we pass to pthread create. Instead, we have a pointer to the values that in that array that each of the threads are passed one element of. And we can extend this further. So the use case I'm showing, I run two threads, and I wait for them to finish before I move on. But because threads let us do things, say, on another core or at the same time, we might want a model where instead we start a bunch of threads, we go off and do something else, and check if the threads are done. And we can do that. But if we're doing that, we probably don't want to try to use a local variable on the stack while we're doing something else. So we can use the same model, but instead allocate that on the heap. So here I have the same info that I passed to the threads. I just allocate it on the heap and get a copy of it later on to both deallocate and retrieve the information about the threads. And I can put, for example, the thread ID in that, so I can join the threads later. Questions? Yes. Okay, so that's about passing stuff to threads. So I showed several strategies. A reason for this is you're going to have to write code with pthread create later, and I don't want you to be clueless on how do I do anything but use global variables. You don't. You have now a method to pass things, even though it looked like void star, what do I do with that? You can make that work. You can pass information to the threads and back from the threads using this kind of pattern. Okay, so now that we've talked about the basics of how threads work, let's look at an example here. And some of you might complain, wait a moment. Shouldn't this have a cast? Let's assume it does. It has a cast to void star, and we have a cast to a void star star here. So even with those casts, assuming this code all compiles, we have the right headers included, there's a big problem with this code, the reason it doesn't work. So what is that? So you're saying the main doesn't return. That is true. That is technically not a problem, but it would still, but let's assume I add a return to the main. It's technically not a problem because C++ and C both have a rule that main implicitly returns zero as a special case that I wouldn't expect anyone to know except by hearing about that rule. But let's assume there's a return zero. There's still an issue. The function, so what doesn't know what compute string is?
Like, does it know where the pointer to the compute string function is? Can it call compute string?
So you're worried about, can we call this function?
Yeah.
It's just a function. If it compiles, we should be able to call it. Yeah.
Result is local to create string, and so when create string exits, result might be deallocated.
Yeah, so your concern is, oh, this result, this is a pointer, a dangling pointer. So where is that, is result stored? Yeah.
Stack.
So yeah, this is stored on the stack of the, stored on the stack of the thread. And we're turning a pointer to the stack of the thread, and after the thread finishes, that stack won't be there anymore. So, you know, it's going to be stored on one of these newly allocated stacks, which is going to go away. So we have a pointer, to bad space. So what would have a fix for this have been? How could we have made this work out? What would be a solution? We want to return this value. What would be a way we could do that? Yeah. So before I say, where you want me to modify code?
Like if you were to put thread join right before you were to make the call to create.
So you want me to move this thread join to here?
Yeah.
So what does thread join do?
Waits for the thread to finish.
Yes. So calling it before we create the thread, there's nothing to wait for. So you want to do the thread join here. So I agree that then, so I agree that there's a case to be made that maybe the pointer would still be valid then. But the problem is that it won't be set to string pointer yet. So we'll need a different solution. Okay, yeah.
Can you allocate the variable in the main thread, possibly using that struct method from before, so that it doesn't then get deallocated when the create string thread finishes execution?
Yeah, so one proposal you would have is that we move this string result into the main thread, pass a pointer to it, for example, and modify the and change this to do star arg equals instead. Okay? That would be one solution. Any others? Yeah.
Use new.
So another solution we could have would be that we could, instead of returning result, a pointer to result, we could return an new string that's a copy of result. Any other solutions? We've missed the simplest solution, which maybe is good because you're all avoiding bad code. Yeah. Yes, the simplest solution is to take this string result here and just move its declaration over here. But most of you sensibly avoided that as a first idea because you realize that's not great style. So there are workarounds for that. Okay. So one thing which got brought up is that you were thinking, okay, so the problem was that the stack got deallocated, and one idea was maybe we could get a pointer before the stack gets deallocated. So this leads us to the question of how are resources allocated for threads and when are they deallocated? So in create a thread, we have to allocate a new stack for it and also the thread control block. So one question we might have, which there's not a great answer to, is how big is that new stack? And the answer is, it varies. And there's not really a consistent answer for what a Unix-like system will do. There is a way we'll show you in a bit of saying how big you want it to be. So when is it deallocated? When are the resources deallocated? And you had a notion that it would happen on pthread join. That's when we deallocate the stack. And POSIX doesn't actually say that. So we can deallocate almost everything when the thread exits. But the POSIX standard doesn't say if that happens or not. But we can't deallocate everything because we still need to collect the return value. Just like with wait PID, we can get rid of the program's memory, but we still need the exit status. We still need the return value around, and we still need to reserve the thread ID until we collect it with pthread join. Otherwise, how is pthread join going to know whether to wait or not? So it's the same as processes and wait PID. So unlike with wait PID, we're going to have a way of saying, you know, it's really inconvenient that you're keeping the thread around, waiting for me to join it. I don't care. Just let it do its thing. So with wait PID, we didn't really have a good way of doing that. There are ways. We didn't talk about them. With threads, we're going to have a way of doing that, and that's pthread detach. So detach says, I don't care about the return value. I don't care about waiting for it to finish. Just let it go and don't keep its resources around when it finishes. I'm not going to try to call pthread join. I'm not going to wait for it to finish. Just make it work. So here my example is we're showing progress. I don't care what the show progress thread does. I'm not going to wait for it to finish. I'm just going to let it run. So I call this detach function, and this says, keep the thread running and don't bother to expect me calling pthread join. In fact, you cannot call pthread join after you've called detach. So in this case, we're changing something about the thread after we start it. There's also a way of setting the thread up this way initially. So when I start the thread, I can use that attributes argument I was leaving as null to say start it detached, meaning I never want to join this. Just when it finishes, clean up all its resources right away. Don't try to keep anything around for me to wait for. I don't care. So you can see to do this, we have this attribute struct, and there's a bunch of functions for manipulating it. And that contains other useful information. And one of the pieces of information it contains is the stack size. So if you care about what the stack size of the thread is, you can use something like this. Here I'm saying, start a new thread with a 32 kilobyte stack. Now, unfortunately, the default stack size, it varies tremendously, like even if you're only talking about Linux. Sorry. It's usually big enough for what you want to do, but no guarantees. Questions about detaching, setting stack sizes? Yeah.
Why would you want to? What situation would you want to detach?
So what situation would I want to detach? If I want to run something in the background and don't care about how it finishes. So I gave the example of show progress, right? I want to show the progress. I don't actually care about monitoring how showing the progress is going or waiting for it to, showing the progress to be done. You know, I'll let it decide when to exit. Other questions? Okay. So something I've done here, which is bad, is I've been calling pthread create with just calling it and just calling it. And if we remember fork, we had to like check if it failed because like we could run out of memory, we could run out of process IDs, and the same is true with pthread create. We could run out of memory, we could pass wrong arguments to it, in fact. Like what if I pass a bogus attributes pointer, like you know, a dangling pointer there? What's gonna happen? How does it tell me if something is wrong? What if I set a negative stack size? And pthread create does return errors. And it returns them in a different way than we've seen before. So the errors are special constants for the return value. So the return value is 0 means everything's OK. OK. And if it's greater than 0, that means error. The number equals a special constant. Number is equals what error, which is one of these constants like e again, or e inval. So e again is you're out of memory. E inval is you did something like ask for a stack size of negative 1 byte. On my slides, to keep my slides compact, I've been omitting error checking. You shouldn't do that. It's really annoying to, you know, find out the reason why your program isn't working is because you called pthread create or pthread join wrong, and it returned an error to tell you that. So please check the error, and this applies for almost all the pthread functions. They usually return an int, 0 for OK, not 0 for not OK. But you should check the documentation because there are a couple exceptions for that. So your typical pattern for feather create should really look something like this. So if you run out of memory or something like that, you don't just compute something weird. So questions about error handling. Okay, so now that we know how to create threads, and we've looked at like having threads compute things, let's try to go beyond our start a thread, have the thread do all its work, and finish, and then collect a result. So that's a way we can use threads, but really, we want threads which coordinate more often. And this is where we're going to start making things a lot more complicated. When we have two threads running at the same time and we care about them accessing things that are shared, our scheduler and how our multiple cores work is going to get us into trouble. So the scheduler is going to be what we'll call non-deterministic. So maybe our scheduler is actually random, like our lottery scheduler, but even if it isn't, it depends on like exactly when I press keys, exactly when things come in on the network, exactly how fast things execute. So it's effectively random. And we can end up running our threads in any order. We can switch threads at any time. And this means if threads are sharing stuff, we can get into a lot of trouble. And with multiple cores, this is worse. Not only do we have to worry about when the scheduler decides to switch between our threads, the cores might run at slightly different speeds. And will cause other things to happen in more orders can imagine. And this is going to arise, or give rise to a class of bugs we'll call race conditions. I'm calling them race conditions because the outcome will depend on whether one thread races ahead of the other. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how we avoid this with what we'll call synchronization constructs, things which keep the threads in sync. But first, we need to go over examples of what these race conditions are and why they happen and sort of what tools we have at the lowest level to avoid them. And I'm going to start with a classic example of an ATM server with multiple threads. So we're going to say we have a server which takes commands from multiple users at once, representing like different ATMs, and the commands are withdraw and deposit. And we have a correctness goal here, which is that we shouldn't lose money. We should do our math correctly so the amount of money makes sense. And we're going to see that we can easily have bugs where this doesn't happen. And our ATM server, so we have a loop. We get a request. And depending on the operation, we call a function to do it. And here's my deposit function. I get a struct pointer that represents an account. I add to its balance. And then I call a function to make sure I've saved that to disk. And you might say, so this is single-threaded. I don't have multiple threads yet. So let's introduce multiple threads, and let's have a reason for that. And maybe a reason we do that is that maybe this getAccount function and saveAccountUpdates function, so maybe it needs to like write things to disk or contact another machine on the network to back up account data. So it could be slow, and even if we have a single core, we're going to be doing I/O, and we want other things to happen during that I/O. So to get full efficiency out of our machine, we're going to want to run multiple of these at a time. And an easy way of doing that is to take this server loop here and just run several copies. So we can do that. My main function, I just decide this number of threads that I'm going to choose is the number which will make sure I get good efficiency, even though we're spending lots of time doing I/O, because while we're doing I/O with one thread, the other thread will do like reading requests and figuring out what to do about them. So if we do this, we can run into problems when the same account is being accessed from two places. And this is even though like this deposit code seems relatively straightforward. And let's look at how that problem happens. And if you look at our deposit code, it might look like, okay, we're just adding a number, like what could go wrong? This is a plus equals operation. The first thing we need to think about is, well, it's plus equals in C or C++. That doesn't mean that's how it turns into in assembly. In assembly, so even if we have a single core, this is probably not just one instruction. And therefore, it probably won't happen all at once. And this is going to be a problem. So a straightforward way of implementing this operation is to read the account balance into a temporary register, add to that temporary register, write the account balance back to where we read it from. But even on a single core, we could have some unfortunate context switch timing. So here I'm saying we have two threads depositing in the same account. So like we have a joint account, the two holders of the account go to different ATMs, deposit at the same time. So what's going to happen? Well, thread A reads the account balance, adds to it, and before it stores, thread B reads the account balance and adds to it. So thread A stores its new balance. Thread B computes a new balance, ignoring what thread A did, and writes it. And it wins. Its write happened last. So on a single core, that's exactly the outcome. Just because the scheduler did something inconvenient for us. And so thread A's money disappeared. We violated the property of not losing money. Now the numbers just don't add up. And this is even though looking at the C++ code looks like, oh, it's one line, what could go wrong? But turns out it's not really one line when we think of it at a lower level. Some questions about this scenario? Okay. So we're going to have to think about, like, when is this sort of scenario possible? So here I have a lost write, and to think about preventing it and what schemes we can use to coordinate threads so they don't have this problem, we're going to think about, well, what are the possible outcomes? I'm going to work through several examples so we can, like, think over this. And we're going to say we have two threads and just two variables at issue, x and y, which both hold integers. They're both initially zero. And we're just saying the threads are running certain operations. What's possible? You have to practice this so we can reason later about, well, how can we make it so the only possible outcome is the one we want? So let's start with this case. This is the warm-up question, so it's meant to be simple. And I'm saying, what are the possible values of x? Thread A is setting x to 1. Thread B is setting Y to 2. What are the possible values of X after thread A and B run? This is the warm-up question. Anyone? No one. Oh, yes.
One.
One is the only possible value. Thread B can't interfere. So that's our intuitive assumption. And we're going to work with that. Now, you might observe, if you're thinking about this hard, what if like x and y are like different parts of the same byte? This might not really be true. We'll work on that later. Let's say they're separate values. So that's going to work. Okay. So how about this scenario? So give me a possible value of x. So I have thread A signs x to y plus 1. And thread B does some manipulation of y. Give me a possible value of x. Anyone? Yes?
1.
1? So how did we get 1?
If x assigns its value first before anything in thread B.
OK. Any other possible values? Yep.
3.
How did you get that?
There would be a context switch in the middle of B. So y equals 2, then x equals
2
plus 1.
OK. Any others? Yeah. 5? OK. And how do you get that? So do thread B first, and then do thread A. OK. Any others? OK. We're good. OK. So that's what I got. OK. So three different possibilities. And this is just with a very simple example. So something that's annoying about reasoning about how threads behave is that the number of possibilities is going to get bigger really fast. Right? I only had one line in A. If I had more than one line, we have a whole other set of things that can go on. So we have to be careful about that. How about here? What are possible values of X? Give me a possibility. Possible value of X. Yeah.
One.
One? Okay. So how did you get that?
Just thread A runs after thread B.
Okay. Another? Yeah.
Two.
Two? How do you get that?
Thread B.
Thread B runs when?
After
A. Okay. Any others? Is there any reason you might be to see another value? Back there?
Zero.
How zero? So you're saying maybe if they're running at the same time. So what would you imagine is happening then? So you went to get zero. How is that going? What are they going to be doing? Saying they're racing each other, so like they're running at the same time, but how? That gives you exactly zero and not something else.
They're not finishing.
Okay, so you're saying that if we check here, we're going to have zero. Let's assume we wait for, we like call pthread join on them. Okay, but it's something, yeah, we'll see zero at some point, yeah.
They run at the same time and it becomes a three.
So they run at the same time and it becomes a three. And so some people are laughing at that. And that's not a ridiculous answer because I didn't tell you how we write to values. Maybe we write one bit at a time. If we write one bit at a time, we could absolutely get three. Now, you're laughing at this because you know it would be stupid to write one bit at a time, but do we know that's not going to happen? We need some rules to reason about this, or we have way more possible outcomes. And like the same is going to be true, you know, in our first example. We can get seven with the same sort of interleaving. No. We need to know something about how values are written, and you intuitively thought, most of you, that, gosh, we're not going to have, we're going to write all of one or all of two at once. We're not going to like write it in pieces so we could have this sort of problem. And that's commonly an assumption we'll make. But we'll have to be careful about that. So we're going to have this concept of what I'll call an atomic operation. So this is something which runs to completion or not at all. We can never observe, and you know, so we won't observe half done atomic operation. So if we're saying reading or writing a value is atomic, we're either going to read the whole value all at once or write the whole value all at once. We're never going to have a scenario where you can see that we write half the value or read half the value and then read the next half. It's all going to happen all together or not happen at all. We're not going to have some in-between points. And on most machines, loading or storing words, that is the type, size of value that fits in a normal register, is atomic. And I have a little caveat here. I say aligned words. So one thing which often isn't atomic is when values cross cache blocks. So that the cache divides memory up into certain pieces, and if we have to go to two of those pieces, many processors have decided, well, that's too bad, we're not doing that all at once. So that's often not atomic. But if they're aligned, meaning they're at an address where that won't happen, like a multiple of the size of the value, then yes, it is atomic on most machines. And you might say, well, gosh, you know, we talked about like switching between threads when the scheduler context switches. That really should be what makes things atomic, is when you can switch And we know exceptions happen at a particular instruction, because otherwise we can't return from the context switch to a particular place. So you might have the assumption, well, instructions are atomic. But that is not, in fact, the case. Some instructions are not atomic. So one example is loading or storing values that cross cache blocks. But there are other examples. So for example, in x86, there's an add instruction that adds directly to a value in memory, a constant. And when I showed you the example of the deposit function, it might have seemed like that add instruction would fix that problem, right? We just have one instruction that adds directly to the amount. What could go wrong? Like, we can't context switch in the middle of the instruction. And indeed, on a single core, that's perfect. We can't, you know, the whole instruction happens or it doesn't before or after the exception, the timer interrupt that causes the context switch. But on multi-core, that's not how things work. So before, I'll go through an example of that, but questions before about what atomic operations mean before I move on. Okay, so I'll have a demonstration. So in x86, we have an instruction. So this is add one to a constant in memory. So the value is a global variable. This is an assembly instruction for that global variable plus equals one. This is all in one instruction. So in a single core machine, we can run this instruction and context switch after it. We can context switch just before this instruction, but we can't context switch during it. But with multiple cores, this instruction can be running while some other core is accessing the value. And the way the hardware implements this instruction is in multiple pieces. This is a pretty complicated instruction in the hardware. So a typical, not necessarily all, but a typical implementation is going to separate the load, the add, and the store. And they will actually happen separately, so we won't get the result that it all happens at once all the time. So I have a program here to try to demonstrate this. So this is a loop in assembly, which runs that increment global variable by one instruction. And it runs the loop a number of times equal to its argument. And I'm passing a million as the argument. So the loop will run a million times in each of two threads, A and B. So I start those two threads. I wait for them to finish. And then I print out the value. And if this add was really atomic, i.e. on a single core machine, we get 2 million. We have 2 million adds happen. But because the add is split up into pieces, we can have this lost write problem, where one thread computes a value with an old version, overwrites the previous new version, and we don't get all the adds seeming to happen. Some of them get lost, just like that deposit got lost. And so I ran this on a lot of times on my desktop, and here are the results I got for the value. This is a histogram of what the value was. This is 2 million, what we'd expect if everything went atomically, and here's the distribution I got. This is probably way more off than many of you expected. But yes, really, it doesn't happen all at once. So questions? Yes. So we can see that not only did I lose a few writes, I lost a lot. I typically got a result as if, like, we got one of the threads adding to a million, or even less than that. Like, I sometimes got less than a million because we had these lost writes. We had threads reading old values, adding based on them, and reading more old values. And lost a lot of adds. So not possible on a single core, but because it's multiple steps in hardware and those steps, the way those steps are implemented, we can have these really strange results and will have them. Oh, and there's some other stuff going on we'll talk about probably next time. So the instructions really aren't atomic. So you might say, well, if if random instructions aren't atomic, what is atomic? So we're going to assume for now that loading and storing words, and I'll say a word like for a 64-bit machine is a 64-bit value, is atomic. And I'm assuming they're aligned, but compilers will like allocate things at addresses which are aligned by adding padding and so on. So that's going to be normal. In general, if you want to figure out what's atomic, the processor designer has to tell you. It's their job to design the processor and caches and so on to work in the right way when we have multiple cores and exceptions. And you have to read what they said they're doing. You can't just guess what's going to be atomic. But this is going to be our building block. And we're going to start with this load and store of particular words and talk about trying to do something useful. Now, I'm going to go through a sort of more grounded analogy where we want to have two threads coordinate. We're going to talk about doing this with humans and have the analogy for threads where we have loads and stores, which we'll represent as like notes between humans. And the problem I'm going to use is two roommates stocking a fridge with milk. So we have a shared fridge, and the two roommates want to go out and buy some milk if there's not some there, but we don't want this scenario where both of them decide to buy milk, and now we have twice as much milk as you need for a week. So how do we coordinate better? Yes?
Make sure they text each other when they're
going to
go.
So text each other or something. So we're going to... That's like not a primitive that looks like loads or stores. So we're going to do something a little different. We're going to talk about leaving a note, because a note sounds like a memory location. So we write a note just by storing. We read the note by loading. With texting, we don't have an analogy for loading, which is going to be very important to know exactly when that happens to think about this. So we're going to talk about leaving a note. But Alice is going to leave a note saying, I'm buying milk. And that should solve a problem, right? So, and Bob's going to do the same thing. So writing the note is going to set note to one. This is almost the same as texting, but we're just going to be precise about when we check the note, because that's important. So we check if there's no milk, and we check if there's a note. We don't want to, after we know there's no milk, we don't want to go buy it if we know that Bob is also buying some milk. And we could probably... For this case, we can say, maybe we check if we got a text from Bob. But we leave a note then. And if we have a note, and left the note, we buy some milk, remove the note. So does this solve our problem? So by me answering that, you might guess, or the quote marks around solution in the title, you might guess not, but why not?
I think they should leave the note in there. Safe, otherwise they could be leaving the note at the same time.
So your problem is, what if they're leaving the note at the same time? And that's exactly what could go wrong. So we can have this sort of scenario where, you know, Alice checks for some milk, signs there's no notes, and says, okay, I'm going to need to go buy milk. And then Bob checks for milk, checks for note, gets distracted for a little bit, and, you know, they both end up buying milk. Because we didn't exactly coordinate exactly when we leave the note and when we check for the note, like they're separated in time and things can happen in between. So we need a solution for this. Someone have a solution. What's the obvious solution for this? Like, yeah.
Global variable?
Well, so our note is a global variable. So you might say the problem is that we're leaving the note after we checked. So let's leave a note before, yeah, sir.
So if you have a box with a lock on it.
So you're getting to another analogy, but we're only going to work, we want atomic loads and stores, right? So how do we implement the box with loads and stores? That's the question we're going to have to get to another time. So I know you have a solution with other tools. And that's a good idea, and we're going to find out we need other tools, but I want to convince us that, yes, we really need them. It's not going to be good enough to just use notes. Okay. And our conclusion is going to be, yes, we need some other thing that the hardware will provide. Is that... Sorry, I'm not going to clamp down eager answers. So one thing we could say is, let's leave a note before we start checking. because our problem was that after we checked, we didn't have a note. So let's see a note beforehand. Does this work? Well, no, for stupid reasons, because we leave a note, then we check for a note, and yep, there's a note. But we know we can avoid that. So we can avoid that by having separate notes for Alice and Bob. So like we have a note from Alice variable and a note from Bob variable. Okay, Alice checks the note from Bob variable, Bob checks the note from Alice variable. Okay, so it seems like this will avoid the problem of buying too much milk, and it does. Unfortunately, by doing this, we've kind of missed out on something. And that is that we don't guarantee that we buy milk. So the problem is that Alice leaves a note, checks for some milk. Meanwhile, Bob's leaving a note. And Alice says, oh, Bob left a note, okay. And Alice doesn't buy milk because there's a note from Bob. And then, gets distracted for a bit, waves hi to Bob. Bob checks if there's milk, then realizes, oh, there's still a note from Alice, decides not to buy milk, and they both remove their notes, and no one's ended up buying milk. So, didn't solve the problem. Now, in the real world, we'd probably figure out, wait a moment, we're both writing notes here, but that's not the primitive we started with. Our atomic loading of store, don't do that. So questions about this scenario. So our atomic loading store don't solve this problem, so just our leaving notes and reading notes, it seems like maybe it's not enough. And also, something I want to get across is that it's really tricky to reason about what's possible. We have solutions which sort of intuitively, you have to work pretty hard to figure out why doesn't this actually work correctly. Because they're things which don't match your intuition about what is possible interleaving, even though leaving the note and checking for the note, we don't have to worry about anything going wrong with those operations. So you might say, is there a solution? And there is. So there is a solution that involves just reading notes and checking notes, and it's really inelegant. So here is an example solution. So Alice leaves a note and checks for a note from Bob, and as long as there's a note from Bob, Alice just waits until that note goes away. And after there's no more note from Bob, Alice checks if there's milk, and if so, not, buys some. And Bob does something different, and this is where it gets really inelegant. You're like, wait, we're doing different things? And so Bob leaves a note, checks if there's a note from Alice, if not, buys some milk. And I assert without proof that this is correct. Proving this, well, you do by doing something where you show you've handled all the possible ways of interleaving, all the orders we could do things in. And I assert if you do that, you can prove it's correct. It is not trivial, and we're not going to do it. And another thing you could think about is that what about extending this to three people? There's a way of doing it. It's not obvious. It's not clear how you do that. But there's a way of doing it. So we're not going to use this method. I wanted to just mention, why are we needing things beyond, reading and writing memory? Because it looks like many of these solutions, if you aren't thinking carefully, it looks like they should work intuitively, especially since they have this nice analogy to leave a note so someone else doesn't do anything. But they don't work because, when we leave a note, we kind of notice if someone's writing the note right now. That doesn't happen with our loads and stores. We don't notice that someone's storing as we're doing it. There is a general solution called Peterson's algorithm. We are going to avoid it. We're going to use special hardware supports. Okay. And so the special hardware support, we're going to implement something that has various names. So there's a concept called mutual exclusion. That means each thread does a particular thing at once. So for example, only one thread at a time manipulates a bank account, or only one thread at a time checks for and buys milk. And note that it's checks for and buys, so we don't have to worry about whether or not someone bought the milk in the meanwhile. And we'll call something which is done with mutual exclusion, something where only one thread does it at a time, a critical section. So we want checking for milk and buying it to be a critical section, so only one thread does it at once. So if Alice is doing that, Bob is not trying to check for milk. Bob just waits for Alice to finish. And we have a primitive we're going to use to implement this called a lock. So that was what the analogy we're going for of like a lockbox. So a lock is our primitive that's going to do this. And we will, I guess, I'll talk about what a lock is, and we'll give some examples next time. Lock has two operations. We can get a lock, and this operation acquires or the lock, and it waits for the lock to be free, and we can unlock it, which lets someone else take it. Since the lock operation waits for the lock to be free, our way of handling the milk problem is we wait for the lock, so we are the only person checking for milk, and then we can buy milk, check for milk and buy it. And since we do all that together, we don't have to worry about someone else doing it at the same time. Okay, that's where I'll finish up today. We'll talk next time about APIs for locks and how to implement them with that special hardware support.